Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 20, where we discuss high reliability organizations, loosely based around Carl Weick's 1993 article about collective mind in organizations. To find out more, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Brighton in the United Kingdom.
This is Ralph, coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico. This is Axios Mile Higher Than Denver.
And this is Rear Admiral, retired United States Navy, Tom Mercer, second skipper of USS Carl Vinson, a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier.
So today we have a very special guest with us, as you all can see. Hi, Tom. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So I'll provide an introduction to Tom. Tom is a career aviator. He started out just flying the planes and then decided that wasn't interesting enough and went on to be the commanding officer of an aircraft carrier. In the United States Navy, one of our particular emphases on high reliability is the commanding officers of aircraft carriers have to be naval aviators as well as graduates of the Navy's Nuclear Propulsion School. So they go through the same training that all the nuclear operators do, even though they're not going to physically operate the plant, because Admiral Rickover believed that was fundamental to safe and reliable operations of nuclear-powered warships, that the commanding officer have a detailed understanding of the plant design and operational characteristics. So Tom, as he noted, was the second commanding officer of the USS Carl Vinson, CVN 70. And one of the particular challenges I'll note this at that stage of a ship's life where you're the second commanding officer and it's shortly after commissioning, there's still quite a bit of molding and developing of the crew. And ship's crews take on a personality largely derived from the commanding officer, but not only derived from that. And that's a special organizational challenge that we intend to ask Tom a little bit more about. Following his assignment on Carl Vinson, Tom was selected for Admiral and had several assignments and culminated in the regional commanding officer, it's what we would call it now, of Subic Bay Naval Base in the Philippines. And while we don't have a base there now, we used to have a very large base there for U.S. naval warships. And what's particular, I believe, about Tom's assignment is he didn't go there and just lay in the sun and drink from coconuts. He happened to be there during the eruption of Mount Pinatubo that essentially destroyed Clark Air Force Base near Manila and caused significant disruptions to the Subic Bay base. So Tom's high reliability organizing and background from nuclear aircraft carriers, I'm sure, served him in great stead. And those are maybe another topic that you might wish to discuss. Did I leave anything important out, Tom?
No, I think that's a good summary. What we're talking about is about, on the aircraft carrier, about 6,000 people supporting 80 aircraft. And the 80 aircraft are your main batteries. So you want to do all your fighting by projecting power ashore and by protecting the ship at least out to 200 miles on all sides. Of course, you have an entire battle group that's helping you do that, including a submarine or two in direct support. But in any case, of that 6,000, though, only 3,000 are under the direct command of the commanding officer half the year. It's clearly when the air wing comes aboard with his 9 squadron, that's an additional 3,000 people with just all the logistics, feeding, basic living, laundry. It's clearly a very much a totally a city at sea, but half your population may wish they were someplace else. No, again, certainly for the officers being at sea and performing your primary mission, particularly for the aviators, it's where it's at. But the living for the other 3,000 people in the air wing, supporting the aircraft and that kind of stuff, you're organized to ensure that they can do their individual jobs just as well on the ship as ashore. It's just much more crowded, and you have to take care of their every every physical need, just like you do for the 3,000 on the ship.
That is amazing. So you're basically in charge of 3,000 people, responsible for 6,000 people aboard a moving city at sea. I mean, that's crazy. How does one get into such a position? How do you grow into a role like that?
Well, it amazes some people that these ships are commanded by aviators that have spent all their career on the ships and squadrons. I guess the end, not leading up to that, but including the times on Carl Vinson, I made 9 different extended deployments in the Atlantic and Mediterranean, and 9 extended deployments to Pacific and Indian Ocean, most of which were 3 different combat tours where I was a combat aviator off Vietnam, and the rest of the time was clearly the physical presence pretty much throughout the world. So to train as a ship driving officer, some people qualify even as junior officers, as officers of deck and that type of thing. Clearly, by the time you're a squadron XO or CO, you know in your career that your flying career is just about half over, and that's comes at the 16th or 17th year of service, and your rest of the time you're going to be driving carriers, particularly if you proceed on up and are fortunate enough to get selected for flag rank. It's still very narrow at the top with regard to getting selected for flag rank, but no captain of a carrier would deny that it's anything other than the very best job in the Navy because of all the responsibility and the total accountability that you enjoy in that position. Certainly with a lot of privileges goes a lot of responsibility. But in any case, rather than always flying off at the end of these short cruises or the workup exercises off the coast, you'd stay aboard and stand bridge watches, and certainly get a lot of experience conning the ship alongside a replenishment ship and some of those other more demanding type things of entering and leaving port and that type of thing, because that's what you you aspire to, but only a very small number of the air wing officers do that. Of course, when you finally get to the job, like all things in Rickover's nuclear power program, the submarines and the surface nuclear ships, you stay in the best job in the Navy for a full 3 years. So you really have an opportunity to make it your own, and the performance of the ship directly reflects the leadership that you've expended as a command officer. Whereas on the conventionally powered ships, very often the command those ships were only for 15 or at the most 18 months, year and a half.
Yeah, that's another Admiral Rickover requirement that the commanding officer's assignment is for 3 years. And something else I would like to expand a little bit on when Tom talks about...
Can I just make a quick reference?
Yes, of course.
That we did discuss Admiral Rickover in episode 11, if you want to go back and listen, if you're unsure who is this person we keep referring to. But other than that, do go ahead.
So one of the things I wanted to provide a little bit more detail on, Tom talked about underway replenishment, which is probably one of the scariest things you can do as a surface, as an officer on a surface ship, whether it be an aircraft carrier or a destroyer or some other kind of ship, because you're taking your ship next to another ship that's got hundreds of thousands of gallons of aviation fuel and high explosive weapons and those kinds of things, as well as food and mail and that. And you're normally with Navy ships, we'd like to stay as far away as from the other ships as possible. There's less likelihood you're going to bump into somebody that way. But for underway replenishment, you intentionally take these very large vessels to within 180 or 200 feet of each other. And you could throw a baseball or tennis ball with great ease from one ship to the other and have somebody catch it. You're that close to them. And so you're talking about thousands of pounds of ships and explosive material, and people all have to function together as a system. And the U.S. Navy considers this a strength of our operational performance. And we actually do it day and night. And night is particularly spooky because, of course, you don't see very much except for just some very dim lights. So that's probably the most challenging thing that surface sailors do next to landing on aircraft carrier for aviators, and aviators get to do both. So that's quite the accomplishment in Tom's case.
I'm very curious, just thinking of this from an organizational standpoint, is that if you think of a business or some kind of a more civilian organization, and you think of it as being 3,000 to 6,000 people in staff, as a CEO or a director of some sort, you wouldn't normally even be co-located with such a huge amount of people in the same geographical area, and let alone interact with them. So I'm just wondering, how hands-on is it being in charge of all these people in a relatively single area of space, or is it hands-on at all?
Yes, it's very very hands-on. You have very good people working for you throughout the whole organization. The average age of the everybody on the ship, not counting the senior officers, runs about age 20 or 21. Of course, in the United States, everybody goes to high school. Most graduate, and they may graduate when mostly of them are 18. And the great bulk of the enlisted troops on the ship then go to boot camp, and then to their technical training, and then right onto the ship. So they've been in the Navy less than a year, and they're out there maintaining and launching aircraft. And so, as I say, the average age is very very young, but it's very hands on. I often say, it's certainly not totally true, that you are spending so much time around the ship, and particularly on the nuclear ship. There's aspects of always being familiar with what's going on down in the plant, always going to nuclear training for presence as much as for your own knowledge. So, and the day work, even for the carrier pilots, unless the deck is really pitching or something like that, becomes very routine, that that you have well-designated lieutenants, either the XO or on a carrier, the navigator, who's a post-squadron command commander, to run the day-to-day operation. Conversely, the night operations are so demanding and require such hands-on decisions on when you're going to refuel the airplanes and what you're going to do if an individual's having trouble getting back aboard, that you hardly ever miss a night landing on the ship. You may be, if you're flying around the clock, you may be sitting up there in the captain's chair with the whole team working around you, and you're dozing off, but you have a speaker right above your head that when an individual comes back and calls the ball, in other words, he's mile and a half behind the ship on glide slope, and he sees the visual landing aid that's going to be the final approaches. He'll call the ball, and you wake up and watch that that airplane land and go back to sleep. But the way or goes off again, waiting for the next airplane. There's all kind of things which I'll describe further about ways you really can communicate and make sure that everybody knows who they're working for. But it is definitely the captain, assisted by all your department heads or on the carrier, or generally post aviation command. Or they are like the reactor officer or engineering officer that have spent their surface warfare officers. So by law, they can't command the ship, but they have spent their whole career on nuclear powered ships, either submarines or cruisers, or mostly other carriers coming up the line. So as I say, they're command qualified type individuals. So it's very hands on, but you very much totally rely on everybody through the team. And it's not just the officers. The chief petty officers of the Navy are specially selected individuals, each in their individual skills. They eat in separate messes. They go through special indoctrination when they become chiefs. I mean, the Navy runs on the technical capabilities of the chief petty officers. And, depending on how much time we have, we can talk a lot about how the chain of command works and how you defer to expertise, one of Carl Weick's primary tenets. But you absolutely do, even though you're in charge and you're accountable, you very much delegate responsibility, but not accountability, down to the lowest practical level, and rely totally on the technical expertise throughout the chain.
Right. So I have a couple observations about some stuff that Tom said, because Tom is very humble And so there's a couple of things I think our listeners would appreciate. One is at the beginning when he was talking about the hands-on aspect, he was basically talking about how involved the CO is in all the major functions that are important for running the ship as a collective organization. And he did mention that the commanding officer actually goes to the same training the junior enlisted and junior officers go to that are organized around the propulsion plant and safety and operations. And the actual expectation from Admiral Rickover mentioned in episode 11 is that the commanding officer will participate in the training. So it's not expected that he'll be a wallflower. He's actually expected to participate and contribute. Now, he's not necessarily going to talk about how many turns of the wrench is going to be on some bolt someplace, but he will provide, was my experience as a reactor officer on the Dwight D. Eisenhower, that the commanding officer will provide this operational perspective based on these many years of experience and understanding of the risks and framing things and putting it in context for people so they get an idea of where they fit in with a larger organization, which I always found very helpful as a reactor officer when the commanding officer did that.
Right. So I think the point there is that it's not about micromanaging, but rather, as Tom mentioned, delegating to who is most capable and able to perform those duties, right?
Absolutely. And in any significant thing like a fire or other significant incident going on, an aircraft accident, things like that, you always have somebody depending on if it's something that's in the captain's purview or the so-called air boss, who's the head of the air department or the executive officer, that you definitely don't want to get in there. You can't get in there and roll up your sleeves. You don't have the technical expertise to really solve the situation anyway. But you're a grand safety observer at the incident, and everybody knows who that individual is. When the captain shows up someplace, they announce captain on the bridge, captain in primary, captain and same thing with the XO. So people know who the senior accountable individual is, but also he's the big safety officer that has to keep the big picture in perspective and not, doesn't get directly involved in the solving the incident itself.
There's a little bit more to it than that, and Tom will fill us in on how he practiced it, but there's a couple things going on here. One is that whole deference to expertise and then being a senior safety leader. It's a fine line that a senior leader in a high reliability organization walks, because you want people to know you're paying attention and that you're engaged and present. But Tom probably couldn't function, nor could I when I was a reactor officer. People were waiting for you to say it was okay or waiting to be told what to do. So what we typically practice in the Navy, and you learn as you go through the various positions and ranks, is what we call command by negation, which means Tom's still in command. So when Tom would go into any situation, he was always in command, and everybody knew that. So this captain on the bridge thing, yep, the commanding officer's on the bridge, and we want to know and announce that to everybody. But he wouldn't normally, and I'm curious on how Tom approached this, but he wouldn't normally tell people what to do. He would just let them know if they were making a mistake or if he thought they should be doing something different. But what you don't want in a large organization of 6,000 people, or in my case, 500 in the reactor department, is for them to be waiting for you, because then they're only operating on your IQ and your capability. And there are some kind of spectacular failures in the Navy and other organizations where that's exactly what the commanding officer did. So Tom, what's your perspective on that, and particularly how you guide people to, you know, relay information to you, but not such that it becomes overwhelming? How does that process work?
Yeah, a good question. You're on the scene, and you really very quickly determine, you know, just watching the whole ballet on the flight deck, and it really is a ballet around. But you become very sensitive to little things. But it would be even on the bridge, very rare for you to override an order or to talk directly to the individual when he or she was trying to do the job. You'd be much more likely to have the navigator or the next most senior guy who's in that, or he owns those people. He's in the organization and is responsible. You'd be using your experience to point out things to him so that he could correct the situation for both for that individual and wherever else he has it in his organization. Now, all this, you know, can take time if it's not done properly. But certainly it's a big deal if the captain ever has to step in, or the XO really has to step in. I'll describe a situation in a minute where that happens. But in any case, and it's very rare that you're actually driving the ship itself, almost never, or that you're really making any real decisions about how somebody's handling the recovery from an aircraft accident and that kind of stuff. You're just monitoring. But the phrase in the Navy is you censure in private, you praise in public, and you censure in private. So you don't want people to be either waiting for you to say something or step in, or they are required from their training to do the very best that they can and muddle on through, if you will. But it's not a muddle. It's a well-planned thing. Conversely, and we can get in a lot of different things of all the methods you have to praise or recognize people for a job well done. Just as an aside, as you may not imagine, totally with the 6,000 people, it really is a city at sea. You have your own television studio and channel. You both play movies. You can go live to the crew. You have announcing systems throughout the ship. There's the so-called pilot landing aid television, which is a little camera right in the middle of the deck that when an airplane is landing, it shows whether he stayed right on center line and right on the glide slope right to touchdown. As soon as he touches down, it shifts to a camera overhead so you can see the rollout of the airplane, clearing the landing gear, then clearing the landing area and all that kind of stuff before it shifts back to the next airplane. I mean, airplanes during the day are landing at every 35 seconds, so this is all good. But that television system is throughout the ship, even down in engineering, because it's important, certainly in all the ready rooms. And with your closed circuit television, just about everybody can pull up the plat, because that's how you get the whole team pulling together to know what's going on the so-called roof on the flight deck. When you're throughout the ship, you hear the catapults when they fire, hitting the water breaks. You hear people land if you know what you're listening for. I mean, the whole ship shakes and it's very noisy, but you also know that because the air wing is your main battery. That's the whole purpose of why you were there. And everybody on the ship is keyed to be through these systems of what's going on. Just an aside, as a city, you have your own bakery even. So they make a bunch of cakes, say, a day, but you'll have a cake cutting two or three times a day for every 1,000th landing for somebody in the arresting gear, for the shop in the arresting gear crew, every 1,000th this, 500 accident-free accident, those type of things. As the captain, you're going, this is how you praise. You go to that shop, you have your photographer with you because you have your Photoshop, you have your own photo people. You take a picture. The people are so underpaid and are living in such a pretty crowded, uncomfortable positions, but then there's no way you can reward them on pay, but you reward them by showing up with a cake, with a photographer, you take the picture. And if it's an individual, you make it a point to send that picture to his family with, a letter from the captain. Just all those little things are all part of living in the city at sea and being a known key part of the city at sea. It certainly plays a part, plays a key part in training. And again, being the second CO, I joined them at sea, already on their first cruise in Australia. But Carl Benson was somewhat unique in that my predecessor, put some, well, this was 83 to 86, several very, state of the art, technical systems on board, including a Wang, email system, of course, just around the ship. It was well before the days of the internet and that type of thing. But in many cases, the training broke down and the operational exercise, the original operational exercises didn't go that well because people were, in some cases, trying to rely more on these systems than they were deferring uh, to to the chiefs and limited duty officers that the technical experts in each individual field that had been on five or six other other carriers during the course of their career for long periods of time. So those are the ones that throughout the chain. The whole philosophy is you're continually changing your relief. You're going to move up, and the guy right below you has to move up. And even the most junior enlisted guy may have only been aboard for 3 months. He's been out on the flight deck. He may be a plane captain, even just a plane pusher, a guy that runs around with the chalks and chains and that type of stuff. But he's not only got 3 months of experience, but he is directly responsible for the life and welfare of the guy that he's training, and the people take that all very seriously. So it's not like you sit down in classroom training, or even that you do a very systematic walkthrough of some kind of evolution for everybody to see. But you learn through doing it, but you're constantly being supervised by a guy that's just slightly senior than yourself.
That's an interesting aspect of high reliability, I think, and I'm very curious to. On the one hand, you're operating these potentially very dangerous systems and learning while doing it, but on the other hand, you can't really learn without getting your hands dirty, so to speak. This may be a bit on the nose. I'm just curious, how does one identify whether a system is brittle or resilient if kind of the outcome is not to cause a catastrophe in either one of the cases? It's usually said that people are the weakest part of any system, and people. So there's this inherent variability that individuals bring to the table, and one has to account for that in a high reliability system, which is so dependent on individuals, rather paradoxically, but also quite empirically proven. And I kind of thinking of that, something that Tom said was he described the flight deck as a ballet, whereas I've also read that it being described as an organized chaos. And I'm just very interested in why you used that metaphor and not the other, and why because ballet is very choreographed in a very controlled way, whereas organized chaos is kind of holding on there, reliability-wise.
All right, so let me give you a start on that one, because I thought about this a lot as well, and Tom chime in. So to me, that distinction, because I spent a lot of time talking with the people on the flight deck themselves when I was on active duty, and they think of it, and so does career aviators, as ballet. Because it's finely choreographed movements that are planned and advanced and coordinated, and much like a ballet is. But then if you're an observer and you don't have that deep system knowledge and expertise, and say you're looking at a ballet and you just look at feet at the ballet and you don't see how the characters are, the subtle signs they use to interact with each other and know where the mark is and know how to do the leaps, those kinds of stuff. It's very confusing to you. And so I think, we in the Navy don't typically refer to it as chaos because we know the planning that goes into it and the rehearsals and the practice moving. They don't just bring a guy onto the flight deck in the first 12 hours he's been on the ship and have him pushing planes around. There's a lot of practicing and preparation that you do. So Tom, what are you thinking about that?
Yeah, I think you captured that a lot. The ballet comes from the fact that it is so synchronized and everybody's doing their job and moving around. And again, to the unexperienced observer, it looks like chaos, and it is like chaos. When we have visitors on the ship, we'll give them sound attenuators and take them out there between the catapults, just so they know just how high the wind is, how slippery the deck is, if you're not careful with the hydraulic fuel and fuel, what it's like out there with this big platform pitching around, all the noise. I mean, it is just deafening noise, particularly when aircraft are in afterburner. There's all kind of dangerous things that more jet blast now than props, but it used to be totally black on the flight deck. Now there's without showing a light out that submarines could track you on the there are systems that at least you have a little bit of light, so you don't run into props or don't run into flaps or speed brakes or anything like that. But I mean, or trip over chains. But I mean, it all comes from experience, and everybody knows what they're doing. And there's always a two-man rule. Everybody's looking out for the other guy that he's responsible for, and vice versa. And some of the ballet comes from the fact, though, that everybody is an individual, and there's all these, there's very much standardized signals, particularly when you're directing airplanes and they're going up into the catapult, and they're going to full power, and cycling all their controls and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of things that could happen wrong, but a lot of things do happen right because of this ballet. But some of the most colorful guys of all, with their little special signals and stuff like that, that means everything to the crew they're working to. It means everything to the pilot. You know, when they finally get ready to launch him, you know, the dance he does, when the airplane's at high power and you either turn on your lights at night or the pilot salutes saying he's ready to go. When he finally touches the deck and the catapult is fired, it's just really a show to behold when it's working properly. And the fact that so many people are trained and doing their job, you can pick out the guy that's causing a problem, or the guy that needs a little extra instruction, or the guy that's hazarding himself and he may not even know it, just being a little bit too close to the tailpipe when it's turning and not really aware of what the pilot or somebody else is going to be doing around him at that point. And that's how people get hurt, if you don't train that out of people when first observed. But the people that are doing the observing are their counterpart the chief that's overall supervising all this.
Right, and it's not abnormal and unexpected in an aircraft carrier for you to be walking along and then get jerked by the back of your collar away from something because somebody saw some hazard that you didn't see. And that is not a reason, and people are trained this way, that is not a reason to turn around and holler at the person. First of all, he wouldn't hear you because of the noise, but, to get upset with him, because that guy probably just saved your life. That's what Tom was talking about. If you were stepping a little too far and getting too close to a propeller, you can count on somebody grabbing you and pulling you back, because that's how people look out for each other on flight decks.
I think that nicely describes this concept of collective mind, doesn't it?
Very much so, yes. Yeah, you're all in the same, when you talked about how you direct people, well, you truly are all in the same boat, all going the same way, and maybe at 30 knots. But everybody's mind is into the business. People, when they come aboard as visitors and you're flying 14, 15 hours, they think for sure that there's probably been some shift work there, and maybe you're only on for 4 hours and off two or something like that. That's certainly the way it is, of course, with bridge watches and some of that. But no, there's no shift work on the carrier. They're, the same people are out there for as long as you're going to fly that way. And so they very quickly both become members of the team and know what to look out for among individuals.
That's interesting, because I always understood collective mind in a different way. And I just listening to you now, I was just thinking that, this is different. So the way you described it, and at least what I understood, is that it's people being very much mindful and tuned in to what they're supposed to be doing on kind of this collective level. Is that correct?
But again, you really try to limit the things they have. I mean, their mind really has to be in their work.
They kind of enact.
No, a lot. That's how people get hurt. Yeah, with any skylarking or any goofing off. You just don't see that even among these 19 and 20-year-old. I mean, they're very serious characters. And as I say, they might all have their individual things to make them colorful and unique and individual, but they're all pulling the same way.
Yeah, the pulling the same way, I think, is a very good way to describe it. Whereas when I was reading the academic work on this, I always kind of conceptualized collective mind as something more meta level, that it's... that you think of the group of people as a Well, I mean, drawing an analogy of the ballet, when you're watching ballet from the audience, it's different than whether you're participating on the stage. So you're alluding to participation, whereas I always thought that it's about just this very coordinated, choreographed, in tune operation of a system. So that's very interesting that you kind of opened my eyes to this different perspective. It's I have to rethink it now.
So one of the things I'd like to ask both is, in high reliability, there's often this emphasis on preoccupation with failure, which many people who don't operate in high reliability organizations find somewhat distasteful, because people don't like talking about failure. They prefer to talk about success. And one of the manifestations, I mean, there's many ways that looks, and it doesn't mean that people in high reliability organizations, at least in my perspective, sit around thinking about bad things all the time. But they do spend a lot of time thinking about, like Todd said, where their systems are brittle, where some of the weak links are, what the performance limits are. When Tom was talking about the training and the expertise and those kinds of things, one of the corollaries of that is you know very well what your performance limits of your systems and their components are. And then there's a lot of training that's not normally visible to people, where you're practicing responses to casualties and responses to abnormal things. And the flight deck regularly, for example, will practice on how to get ready for a plane that's coming in on low fuel or damaged or something like that. So they know at least some of the things to expect and where things do and do not go well.
Yeah. Well, this is going back a little bit too on the question of resilience or brittleness. You know, all the time, you were thinking about where the failures may be, where the problems may be, and you're testing the limits. That's why the captain has to be an aviator, because he's done it himself. He would have no credibility of sending guys out on a black stormy night and the deck pitching and all that kind of stuff. If he'd have no credibility if he hadn't done it himself. And he wouldn't know just how far to go. I mean, only the captain can really stop or start flight operations. And you train in peacetime to the same level and the same tempo of operations that you're going to do in wartime, which not only, you have a good idea where your margins are and then you come back a little bit from them, but it also gives everybody, self-confidence that, hey, we handled that. We survived. You know, and now we're ready to take the next step forward. But you don't, you wouldn't really get that knowledge if you don't very carefully debrief. So the debriefs, you know, essentially for the flight off the ship, now, you know, with tankers and stuff like that, and long flights into Afghanistan or even into Iraq, places like that, some of these guys are flying 7 or 8, 9 hour flights with 2 or 3 refuelings, not only refueling from your own airplanes, but Air Force airplanes. But in any case, but in the past, you know, most hot flights for jets were about 1 hour and 45, hour and 50 minutes. But in any case, you start briefing 2 hours or 1 hour and 45 minutes before the flight. Of course, that includes all the time to review the logs and go up there and man your airplanes, you know, get in your gear, man your aircraft, all that kind of stuff. But when you come back, you absolutely debrief, sometimes just as extensively as that. And after my time as a pilot, we really got into the operational risk management techniques where there's a regular form you fill out, in addition to the debriefs, which were always very extensive, of looking at all the, even the, some of the psychometric, some of your sleep deprivation, various things, the condition of the pilot, what may be on his mind, how much he's flown before, you know, how long it's been since he flew at night, just what is the quality. In any case, that and all the other operational things is a regular form that you can put empirical. You can put numbers to it and decide whether you're gonna fly that night, or if that crew is in fact ready to fly or not. And then when you come back, you go right back to that form and check off what was good and what was bad and what surprised you and really going to school on any incidents and minor things. And you get rewarded. Squadrons get rewarded for reporting incidents of all sorts. Because that's reporting the incidents and learning the lessons is what keeps you from having any accidents.
And what happens to that form afterwards?
It is just kept in the squadron, and even in case of a of a accident. Yes, it could become part of the record, but it is it's used as a self-teaching tool. But it's not just self, of course. It's the squadron skipper, the CAG. Here, particularly for people that are individual aircrew or even teams that are having troubles, it'll go up to whatever level it needs to go, so the lessons are learned. And you know, in such a complex team, it's very seldom. I mean, in just about every aircraft accident, there's some amount of pilot error assigned. Even if it was a pure materiel failure, because even after you've had your materiel failure, how well you've you handled the thing, and how well the whole team, you know, the flight deck crew, the air boss, the decision making on the bridge, decision making down in air operations, you know, all those things become factors in the accident. But in any case, both the formal incident reports and particularly accident reports are very formal. Reports with maybe attachments if that stuff is applicable, but in general, just like the plat tape, you know, after everybody's landed, the landing signal officers come around and each pass is graded. That's how you maintain the quality of the thing. And it's there's a big board in every ready room of all the people, how many red, green, yellow, and cut passes you have. I mean, it's a real thing every line period and every cruise. To be the tops on the so-called the greenie board and that kind of stuff, those passes are graded. The LSO's word is the gospel. Even if he's grading the skipper or the CAG, and it's just like a variety of other reports. And I started to mention the plant tape. I mean, you don't necessarily keep that record very long. But it's there for at least 3 or 4 days, just in case some question might come up. What fell off the airplane when it landed, or what somebody saw when the airplane was being launched off the bow. Those kind of things. You may be lucky, and it'll be in the platform.
Well, right. And one observation I want to make about the greenie board is that there's probably few professional organizations much more stringent about performance than high reliability organizations and aircraft carriers, because if you get a certain number of, you know, low performance marks on your landings, you're put in a remedial status. You're basically maybe not taken out of a flight status exactly, but you're put on watch, and you actually have to work on that particularly. And if you don't improve, you will be removed. I don't think you're removed immediately, Tom. Don't you have to do a board on the somebody first?
Yeah, you have fleet aviation evaluation boards.
Right. So an example somebody told me one time was he was a pilot of an A-6 intruder aircraft, which is no longer in commission, but those two seat bomber, heavy bomber aircraft the U.S. Navy used for many, many years. And he was having these problems, and his landings were deteriorating, and he was given a board. And the squadron CO, he doesn't set the board, actually. It's other department heads or senior leaders of the squadron that set the board and evaluate this person's performance and understanding of the aircraft and those kinds of things. And they provide a recommendation to the squadron CO. So that what was being told to me was the board reviewed this person's record, and they said, well, you know, he basically just needs some more confidence and should be sent back stateside for more chances to improve. In a squadron, and the CO looked at this and said, okay, fine, but we don't have time to do that given the operational tempo, and there's no place to send this guy right now. So he's either going to stay here and fly, or we're taking him out of flight status. And since you, the senior officer of the board, recommended retaining him, you get to sit next to him on all his future flights, and you're going to be the guy that helps him get better. And my friend who was telling me the story said he expected that, actually. That was the response he got. So occasionally he would be coming in for a landing, he'd have to whack him in the head with a clipboard to get him to pay attention to what was going on. But that's how seriously they take that stuff.
Yeah, the junior officer establishes his entire reputation around the ship. You know, he may never get bombs on target. In fact, you really have to watch that. And if you're an attack pilot or a fighter pilot, as the Air Force calls it, to make sure that people pay the proper attention in the few seconds you're over a target, either practice target or real, that's your primary mission and that you do well there. But you're never going to get graded on that. You are going to get graded on how your landing is when you get back to the ship. In daytime, you're taking your own interval and you're really shooting exactly for that 35 seconds because it takes about 29 or 30 seconds for all the arresting wires to get back into gear and for the visual landing aid to be set for that particular airplane and for that particular weight of the airplane, all of which just the science of doing that and how that happens. Within 29 seconds before the deck is clear for the next airplane is another interesting thing that's been studied by some of the Berkeley group that got on the ship and that kind of stuff. But in any case, yeah, it's the greenie board is everything. And as long as you can safely come back aboard the ship, particularly at the night, you're gonna be golden unless you get involved in a major incident or accident. But the night carrier landings are so demanding that people's eyesight, you'll start noticing it first in the night landings. They just don't have the definition on the visual landing system out there at a mile and a quarter to get a good start. So they're making corrections and maybe behind the airplane all the way down. And it reflects in the night landing and the night grades quicker than anything else. And when those things happen, we have so much experience on it now, which we might not have before. Then there's a major medical workup on the ship, and it could go all the way back to the Navy Medical Research Institute at Pensacola, Pensacola, Florida, which is the final arbitrator of things medical of what your flight status is and what you're qualified to fly. But I mean, there's no. No kidding you. There's enough different people grading various aspects of the performance and keeping records that is a lot more than in the past. There's no pulling any wool over anybody's eyes. And in fact, the pilot is not going to turn in his wings, no matter how many times he scares himself. It is the responsibility of leadership to just get him whatever kind of help and evaluation that he needs.
Right. And I think an important aspect of that, as you highlighted repeatedly, is that there is a degree of transparency and non-punitive evaluation that doesn't discourage people and groups of people from engaging in this exercise, really.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not punitive. It can certainly be career detrimental, and it could be through no fault of your own, and usually often is because of something, but even psychological things or things happen at home. I mean, these forms, the briefing forms, attempt to get to any of those kind of things, the letter you've gotten from your girlfriend that day and all that kind of stuff and how much sleep you had and everything else. But but a lot of it is just you're living so closely together. I mean, when you're on the carrier, everything for the pilots is in the ready room. That's their general quarter station. That's where they brief for flights. That's where they debrief for flights. That's their office when they're not flying. You want to have a ready room very close to the mess because the only thing you leave the ready room for is to sleep or to eat.
Or to eat.
And that's all for part one of episode 20. Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this discussion as much as we've enjoyed recording it and that you're finding all the amazing things that Tom is sharing with us eye-opening and evocative of the theory that we're approaching here. If you're enjoying this podcast, please take a minute, go and leave us a review. If you're listening on iTunes, if you could write us, that'd be fantastic as it increases the visibility of the podcast for new people who may not know about us yet. Tell your friends, colleagues. We'd be very appreciative and extremely happy to get more people listening and talking about organizations. So please join us next week as we continue and finish our discussion with our very special guest about collective mind and heatful interrelating on flight deck, as well as Tom Mercer's personal wealth of experience here on Talking About Organizations.